Well, it's really good to be here. Get old students all over the building. It's great to see all of you. Raise your hand if you're a student of mine. Wonderful. Got old friends from Donaldson here. Gotten squared away on the spelling of alligator. It's been a blessed evening. Reminded me of my favorite student evaluation of all time I've ever gotten. My student evaluations tend to kind of gather at the polls. You know, there are some who think I'm the greatest teacher since Jesus Christ, and those who think I have 666 plastered on the back of my head, and almost nothing in between. And I got one evaluation from a student who said, this guy would be a pretty good teacher if he wasn't such a big jerk. And they spelled jerk with a G. and I don't really mind being a jerk, but being a gurk, I mean, that's... everything starts with a G, though, I learned tonight, so I guess that's all right, huh? I didn't know where to go with this topic about having to live simply in a complicated world. I assumed I was going to primarily be talking to Christians. And one of the unfortunate things is that we've let our Christianity become as complicated as the world already is. And so what I want to do is take one kind of aspect of living the simple life, which is sort of getting clear about our mission. Is once you get clear about who you are and what you're trying to do in the world, then things just get a lot simpler. I wear this cross you see on all the time. I almost always wear it inside my shirt, though, but I didn't have any place to clip the microphone. And the reason I usually wear my cross inside my shirt is because when you wear all black and you wear a cross, people will ask you for a blessing. But that's not the only reason. One of the big reasons is because when people see my cross, I'm not so sure what they see. I recently was in an airport where I spend a good deal of my life, and I had plopped myself at a gate where there was no activity so I could read. And wouldn't you know, as I'm sitting there reading, a plane comes into that gate, and this is in a DFW airport, and all these people come piling off the plane, and this young lady proceeds to set three or four chairs for me and commences to weep. I don't know what's going on, you know. I don't know if she's missed her plane at DFW. There's a good chance of that. You know, I don't know if her boyfriend's dumped her or she's dumped him. I don't know if her mother's died. I don't know. But I'm not just going to sit there. And so I'm trying to make this split-second decision as I walk up to her. I'm trying to decide, do I do it cross in or cross out? Now, there is something kind of funny about that, but if you let it work on you, it's not funny at all. Because I have to decide whether I'm more likely to get a welcome reception if she identifies me a Christian or if she doesn't. Is she going to be thinking, if I go with my cross out, this is the guy who's going to try to take advantage of me, he's going to try to get my money, he's going to try to force me to do something, he's going to whap out his Bible and tell me to quit crying? Or is she going to be thinking, oh good, there's somebody who's going to lay down their life for me? I want to just take one little text and think about getting our identity back and how that would greatly simplify our lives. And the text I want to look at is Luke chapter 15. And this is kind of dicey because you all know this text so well. And you're going to assume that I won't be able to say anything about it that you haven't already thought, which is probably true. But I'll just confess at the beginning that I have not understood this text correctly for most of my life. I have been extraordinarily slow about understanding the prodigal son text, which I think is a very dark story. I think it's intentionally dark. I think Jesus is kind of calling us out in this story, and I want to kind of do that too and think about even though this doesn't make life easy, it does make life extraordinarily simple. You know, I'm so slow. I got to do something recently I'd never done before. I got to go to my first tool shower. How many of you have been to a tool shower? Okay, a few of you have. Oh, they're a lot of fun. My graduate assistant was getting married, and his wife had had one wife-to-be had had one wonderful shower after another, and so his buds decided he needed a shower too, so they threw him a tool shower. So he went and registered at Home Depot, and we all went out and got him a different tool and went to the tool shower. Now, tool showers are a little different than your ordinary showers. For one thing, it doesn't take nearly as long to open the presents. Because at a regular shower, you have to open each one individually, pass it around the room while everybody takes it, looks at it, and says, ah. At a tool shower, you open it, say, that's a wrench, toss it down, pick up the next one. So like in 10 minutes, all the gifts are open. And so now I'm wondering, okay, what happens next at a tool shower? Now, I should say that most of the bad things that have happened to me in my life have happened because of the company I keep, which is primarily 18 to 22-year-old guys. So the host of the shower says, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to go around the room and everybody is going to describe their most disgusting illness or injury. And with a bunch of college guys, this was highly entertaining. I, on the other hand, have very little to offer. You know, unless I fall off my chair at the library, you know, it's not apt to be an injury. I couldn't really think of anything then. About the only thing I've been able to think of since is those of you who remember when I was here, I'm the proud owner of two pugs. The reason I have pugs is because I did not do sufficient research. And my first little pug was unusually stubborn even for a pug. And I really couldn't get him to do anything, so I sent him to obedience school. And so he'd been there a week, and I went to pick him up, and the guy said, he's not ready. And so I had to go back home, come back a week later. My dog got detention. So I come back, and he says, okay, he's great. He can do everything now. And sure enough, he would heal, and he would sit, but he didn't like to lay down. I'd say, down. He'd just stare at me. Didn't bother me much, but the dog trainer was being paid a great deal of money to correct this behavior. And so he says, no, you got to call him by name. You got to do the actions. You got to do it like you mean it. And I said, all right, Proko, down. And I got a little excited, and I went down too far, and I jammed my finger into the driveway we were standing on. And my finger split. So now I have a little blood running down my arm. And the guy looks at me for like 30 seconds and finally says, and I thought the dog was slow. So that's kind of where we are on this text. I've been really slow. You may have gotten there before I did, but anyway, humor me. Luke 15 starts out, it tells three stories, and I'm absolutely convinced the first two stories are a setup, the third story is the point. Now, this is one of the reasons why Jesus is my favorite preacher. He is so good with a sucker punch, which is my favorite move. You know, he tells you two happy stories, he's got you going, and then he zings you with this third one. He always tells you one more story than you want to hear. Okay, let's hear the happy stories first. Verse 3. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? When he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep. I tell you, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. In the same way, I tell you, there's rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Happy stories. Stories about the God who doesn't just wait to be found, but who goes out and searches. Some Christian theologians have said this is the most distinctly Christian idea about God. The other ideas that Christians have about God you can find in other religions, but this is a truly extraordinary idea. That is, God doesn't just wait for human beings to find him. He goes out and he looks for them. Now that's good news. And I am tempted, you know, to spend the whole evening regaling you with stories about how across the world God is searching and finding. Now, I won't do that. I'll maybe tell you a couple. I don't know. Are you aware that in 1900, probably 7% of the population of Africa would have claimed to be Christian? And today, 100 years later, that number is 46%. Half the continent has gone Christian in just a century. Africans are now leaving their own country and going to other African countries to evangelize. There are more African Christians than there are United States Christians. We have a few African missionaries in the States. And we're a generation away from having a bunch of them. The center of Christianity is Africa. God seeks and finds. I actually find the story in China even more amazing. In 1900, best estimate was that 0.5% of the population of China would have claimed to be Christian. Today, 100 years later, and they hadn't been a real good 100 years in China, best estimate is that 7% of the population of China would now claim to be Christian. And you're thinking, well, I'm not impressed, 7%. We're talking about China here. Now think about that, 7% of a Chinese. There are more Chinese Christians than there are American Christians. They have little house churches of 100,000 people. It's all underground. No churches, no steeples, just Christians everywhere. We have a woman in ACU in our family marriage and family therapy program who is from Hong Kong. Her husband regularly goes into China, and he tells us there are 100,000 Chinese missionaries ready to go across the world when the borders open. And they have this wacky theology that says the gospel needs to go back where it came from. It came from Jerusalem, it needs to go back to Jerusalem. So they're going to take the gospel and head to Jerusalem. Now, if you know your geography, that's going to take them right across Muslim countries. Now, listen to how twisted this is. God is going to evangelize Muslim countries with Chinese missionaries. Anybody have that one on your strategic plan? God is seeking and finding all over the world. My friend Everett Hufford says, you know, most of the news in North America is bad, but it's not all bad. You know, he says, we've been so reluctant to evangelize our neighbors to the south that God has decided to be very good to us. He said, okay, you don't have to go. I'll just bring them to you. You know, so I don't have to go anywhere. All we have to do is just learn a language and we can, you know, have this unprecedented opportunity to evangelize Hispanic peoples. God is seeking and finding. And every once in a while, we ought to lift up our eyes and look around the world and see what God is doing. He hadn't gone out of business. He's doing really well. And just as I'm feeling really good about that, Jesus tells one more story. A different story. A darker story. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off to a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill the stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on and put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Now, if the story stopped there, it would be very much like the other two. In fact, it would be the same story exactly, except for just one minor difference. God is still seeking in this story. He runs out to meet the son. The only thing that's really different about this story is the manner in which the son got lost. I do not know how the sheep got lost. I assume the sheep was not being malicious. I understand sheep are a little slow. And so I assume the sheep was lost because the sheep was dumb. I don't know how the coin got lost. I assume the coin was not responsible for its own lostness, even though I have been known to blame inanimate objects for their lostness. But I know how the son got lost. He was self-centered, willful, sinful. Bad news. That's how he got lost. And other than that, the stories are remarkably similar, which is how I know that the rest of the story is the real point. Because Jesus now introduces a totally extraneous character, the older brother. So if all he wanted to do is reinforce the first two stories, he would have stopped where he did. But he doesn't want to do that. He actually wants to say something else to us. Verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied. "Your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you're always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." At one level, what Jesus is doing in this story with the older brother is obvious. All you have to do is go back to the first two verses in the chapter, see what gave occasion for Jesus telling the stories in the first place, and you see the reason he introduces this older brother. See the first two verses. "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him, but the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" So these religious leaders are complaining about the company that Jesus is keeping. He's hanging out with sinners. So when Jesus tells these stories, he sets them up with the first two, and then he tells them the third story, and he writes them into the story. Because even if they were a little slow, they couldn't help miss the fact that they're the older brother in the story. You know, they're the ones who are complaining about him hanging out with these sinners. They're the ones who won't come in and join the party. Now, I don't mind Jesus doing that. I really don't. My problem is this. When Jesus wrote them into the story, he wrote me into the story too. And I do find that a little objectionable. You see, when I read this story, I like to read it like I'm the prodigal son. But I'm not. I'm the older brother. I didn't have a prodigal son experience. My parents were very strict. I was not allowed to sin. I am the one who has been slaving away all these years. I wasn't born on a pew, but I got there very shortly thereafter. I've been there ever since. I don't just go to church on Sunday. I go to church almost all weekend, every weekend. If there's a certain quota for going to church, I could quit now and I'd tell you I'm in. I've got about as many Saturday credits as a Seventh-day Adventist has, I got to tell you. And I've been working and working and trying to make the church a fit place to be. And then lo and behold, Jesus throws open the doors and invites in this punk and wants me to make room for him. Is that what you're telling me? Jesus says, "You're a little slow, But now you got it. And boy, if you take that seriously, life isn't going to be easy. But it's amazing how that simplifies things. Because when I'm the older brother, I have a lot to figure out. I have to figure who deserves to be in and who deserves to be out. I have to decide who's worthy of a party and who's not. I've got to decide who's going to be a fit member for this group and who's not. I've got to decide who we can welcome and whose sin we just can't tolerate. But if I don't act like that, all I have to do is say, okay, God's throwing the party. I'm invited. Let's party. Now, that's not easy, but it's really simple. All you have to do is ask the question, what's God trying to do in the world? What's God trying to do for the prodigal son? And then you know what to do. Throw open the doors and party. And how is it that we as Christians have gotten preoccupied with everything but that? Leonard Sweet is one of my favorite writers, and maybe because he says things that I generally agree with, but mostly because he's got a way with words. You know, he knows how to turn a line. And one of my favorites from Leonard Sweet is he says, the church loves blue hair. The church loves blue hair unless it's on a 16-year-old kid who looks like he's crawled out of a tackle box. Then we're not so sure. We're not guardians of the church. We're the people who welcome in whoever Jesus welcomes in, and who he welcomes in is everybody out there. He wants them all. And life isn't easy when you invest in that mission. But it is extremely simple. You start asking the one question. How do you welcome the prodigal? How do you become the church of the prodigal? How do you become the group of people that carries out the mission of God in the world? It's not easy, but it's simple. In one of my former lives, I used to do worship seminars for churches. I seldom do this anymore. I would go to a church that was being torn apart by the worship wars, and I would do a seminar. And the reason I don't do this so much anymore is every time I went to a church and did that, things got worse. There's a reason for that. The only thing that's holding some churches together is lack of communication. You go in there and clear that up, and you have really got some issues. So I would go into a church, and they suspected they didn't care for each other. And by the time I left, they were quite sure about it. I would go in there, and usually these things would wind up on a Sunday. And I'd always do the same thing on Sunday. I would conspire with the song leader and tell him, I want you to lead three songs about the same topic. I want one of them to be a classic hymn, I want one of them to be a Stamps Baxter song, and I want one of them to be a contemporary song. And then I threaten him. I want you to lead them all with equal conviction. You are not to prejudice the case. And so he'll lead all three, and then right there in church, I'd have everybody vote on which one they liked the best, with their eyes wide open. Now, it wouldn't quite split into a third and a third and a third, but pretty close. The classic hymn was always a little less than a third because there are very few of us who have really good taste in church music. But it'd be pretty close. And I'd say, okay, now you know what it's like to be a song leader in this church. No matter what you're leading, two-thirds of the people wish you were leading something else. And you also know something else. You know, really what this is about is, which is more important to you, your taste in church music or the people who had their hands up when you don't? Because that's about what it comes down to. And that's not a question of style. That's a question of spirituality. That's a question of what kind of people we are. Now, you can see why that doesn't work all that well. If I were going back to those churches, either one of them that would grow out of that experience, I just had flashed through my brain the variation of the Church of Christ guy on the island joke. You know, Church of Christ guy island by himself. They finally rescue him. There's three buildings there, and they said, "What's that one?" He said, "That's where I live." I said, "What's that one?" He said, "That's where I go to church." I said, "Okay, what's that one?" He said, "That's where I used to go to church." If I were going back to those churches now, I'd want to say one more thing. I'd want to say, I hope you're not having this conversation next time I come back. Because do you know how narrow this conversation is? I hope next time I come back, what you're talking about is punk and rap and gungy, grungy, whatever it is. Because I hope you're reaching all sorts of those people, and they're going to bring their music and everything else about them in to be redeemed. And when you do that, church will really get interesting. Now, that's not going to be easy. I can't tell you how that has simplified my life. As I've gotten older, I have found fewer and fewer things that I care anything about. And I have found that what generally made my life so complicated is I had this infinitely long list of things that I was preoccupied with. And as they say at the Church of the Savior, if you're overextended, you're undercommitted. And now there's only two things I really care about. One is how do you have a deep, transformed spirituality that actually makes you different in your Christian life from most of the world around us? That's one. And the other is, how does the gospel penetrate those parts of our culture which it's hardly touched? And my life has gotten much simpler when the list of 100 has become a list of 2. And you just keep asking the question over and over again. How is this going to serve God's mission in the world? This is a dark text, and it's scary. You know, if what I've described to you doesn't scare you, then I just haven't done a good job of communicating it. Because when we get about God's mission, life gets simpler, but it also gets incredibly messy. Because the kind of people that Jesus Christ wants to reach with the gospel are going to mess up your church. They're going to. But what makes that simple is this. You have to recognize that you're not going to be in control of it. That'll be a little hard for some of us because we like to be in control of everything. I'm kind of like that. You know, I'm one of those preachers who I like spontaneity in my services as long as it's really well planned. You know, I want. That's why I never work with kids, Brandon. Never work with kids. They do not know how to color in the lines. I want to be in control, but you know, if you get on this mission of God, what you have to recognize is no one but God Himself is going to be in control of it. And in a lot of ways, that makes your life less complicated because you don't have to ask the question, you know, is this going to go well? The answer is no. You don't have to worry about the question about how successful this is going to be because it's going to fail over and over and over again. You don't have to worry about any of that. And what you do at the end of the day is you rely on the fact that God can handle it. And when you get on God's mission and you do the kind of things that He's calling us to do, that at the end of the day, He can keep the bus in the middle of the road. Example I usually give is of my recent experience bungee jumping. A thrilling experience. How many of you bungee jumped? One, two. I see all women. Okay, one man. Oh, I was in Thailand, and I had the same problem, 18 to 22-year-old guys. We were out driving around doing one church thing after another, and they said, "We're going right past the jungle bungee jump place. You want a bungee jump?" I said, "Sure." just a little white lie, you know. So a couple of them went first. Now it's my turn. And wouldn't you know, the Thai guy who's helping me is a comedian. He ties the bungee on my ankles. He looks down at it and says, "Does that look right to you?" I said, "What?" And he says, "I can never remember how to do that part." I'm now on the top of the tower. It is 50 meters high. That would be about 150 feet for those of you who are Americans. And, you know, I have the bungee on my ankles, and so I go, okay, here I am. I'm looking down, and it didn't look that high from the bottom. But from the top, it's like you're looking through wisps of cloud. And I say, okay, okay. My heart is beating. I can hardly breathe. I think I can't do this. And then I look at those college guys down there, and I think, well, I got to do this. You know, my life will not be worth living if I don't jump off this tower. So I say, okay. And then my little Thai helper behind me says, head first. Okay, I've got the bungee tied on my ankle, so I can't just jump off. I'm going to get really yanked. I got to dive off. So I say, okay. Okay. I become very articulate when I'm a little nervous. He can see I'm having a little trouble, and he says, okay, I'm going to count to three, and you jump. I said, let's make it 30. He says, I cannot count to 30 in English. I said, I'm prepared to wait for you to learn. He says, three. And I said, okay. He says, one, two, three, and I dive. And, oh, it's a rush. You're just free falling. And I didn't scream. It wasn't because I wasn't trying, but I now understand the silent scream. You know, I was, and then you're bouncing up and down, upside down, looking at the world. It was great fun. I'm never doing it again. You know. Yeah, I learned an important lesson. You know, you don't jump off that tower unless you believe at some fundamental level the bungee's going to hold. And entering into God's good mission, the mission where the prodigal gets welcomed and church and individual life is transformed by this mission of God, is like jumping off the tower. And this is what I want to tell you that makes it simple. God's got you. You don't have to worry about it. God has got you. In all the churches I'm in, the biggest problem they all have is this. We are just so afraid. We are afraid to get out there on God's risky mission because we're just not absolutely convinced God's got us. And if you ask the questions, what's going to happen to us if we do this? I got the answer for you. I have no idea, but it's going to be awful. Isn't this going to be great? Because God's got us. Oh, I don't know if that makes life simpler or not. It does to me. It does to me. I'm weary of trying to make it all work. I'm tired of the complications of church. I'm tired of the complications of theology to which I've dedicated my life. I'm tired of the complications of my own life. In the last few years of my ministry, I wanted to get very simple. I want to think about what an authentic Christian life looks like. And I want to think about how the gospel is going to reach all of the prodigals in our culture. I want you to hear this and take it seriously. A dozen years ago, there were 39 million unchurched people in America. Today, that number is 75 million. The increase has been 95% at a time when the population has grown by 15%. The cause for which Christ died is not just losing in North America, it is being routed and decimated. And it had better get simple for us if we're going to reverse that trend. We've got to become authentic in our own lives so that people will see when we're calling them to be a Christian, we're calling them to something real and life transforming. And we have got to start to care about that blue-haired, pierced boy and that gay couple and that woman who had the abortion, and that Iraqi. We've got to make sure they know that when they see a cross, those are people who will lay their lives down for them. That's not going to be easy, but it's simple. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and give you peace. Now to Him who is able to keep you from falling, to present you before His glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Jesus Christ our Lord, be glory and majesty, dominion and power before all ages, now and forevermore. Amen.